Let me begin with a minor correction from last night. Found out that I was off by a century on the date for the Articles of Perth. And I did some double checking and found I'm off two more years. It was 1618 is the date of the Articles of Perth. That's not of earth-shaking importance, but in the interest of accuracy. We're in the Second Reformation, page 4 of the notes tonight, and I begin with another note about the monarchy. James VI of Scotland, the man responsible for the King James Version of the Bible, not that he did the translation, but he authorized the setting up of a committee to do that translation. He was James VI in Scotland, but in 1603, Queen Elizabeth I died, and Elizabeth never married and had no children, so there was no heir to the throne in England. At least no heir that had a closer relationship, a closer claim on the throne than James did in Scotland. So in 1603, he became also King of England. And he actually moved south and lived the rest of his life in England and ruled in Scotland by way of a representative, usually called the Lord High Commissioner. James died in 1625, and he was succeeded by his son, Charles I, who also was King of Scotland. But he's Charles I both in Scotland and in England, because there had been no previous king by the name of Charles in either country. Charles grew up in England. Scotland was really a foreign country to him. He, of course, was the head of the Church of England. He also had authority in the Church of Scotland, but his religion was Anglican, strongly in favor, as his father had been, of bishops governing the church, and he was sympathetic to Catholicism. His wife was a Catholic, a practicing Catholic all of her life. When the Westminster Assembly drew up a directory for worship, they had in it suggested prayers, and in the suggested long prayer, there was prayer for the conversion of the Queen and for the religious education of their children, meaning that they would be a prayer that they would be raised Protestant and not Catholic. So in the Westminster document, then, there's a reference to this situation. So this was another political alliance, and happened that she was from, she was Catholic. One of the first things that Charles did as he became king was to direct the rigid enforcement of the Articles of Perth, which had been passed under his father in 1618. And this had a really interesting impact in Scotland. The stricter Protestants, the stricter Covenanters, objected to these Articles of Perth. They had to do with worship and how it was to be performed. They certainly had the appearance of return to Catholic practice, kneeling to receive communion, for example, observance of special holy days, private communion and baptism, and episcopal confirmation. Those were all practices of the Roman Catholic Church. It looked like it was a return to that. And they were also in violation of the regulative principle of worship. That is, no biblical ground was given for these directions, these commands that were made. And so I think it's important to see that in that setting, at the time of the Reformation, and even into the next century, the regulative principle of worship was really a principle of liberty. We sometimes, I think, are tempted to think that it's restrictive. But what it does is to set the church free from what Jesus called the doctrines and commandments of men. And there's a chapter on liberty of conscience in the Westminster Confession that talks about the conscience being free from doctrines and commandments of men, particularly in matters of worship. Well, Charles is going to exert his authority as the head of the church, and so because his whole experience and his preference is for an Anglican form of worship, he wants to see that enforced in Scotland as well. And in God's providence, that really served for the furtherance of the gospel. This is an interesting thing about providence, that the measures that are taken by enemies of the gospel to try to hamper it and forbid it often turn out for good. I think often of parallels between the situation in Scotland and the present situation in China. And so think about China, where foreign missionaries were expelled by the communists in 1950 with the thought that that would hamper, if not put an end to, Christianity. But as you know, the church in China has grown in the last 60 years on a scale that has never been known before under persecution and with the removal of the missionaries. And there was a similar thing here. What happened is that pastors who refused to follow these directives in their pastoral ministry were removed from their pastorates. That was a severe hardship. They didn't have income, they didn't have a place to live, but they were often welcomed into the homes of the more affluent people in Scotland, or they traveled around preaching here and there, not in a settled, as a settled pastor in a congregation. And they were the more zealous, the more committed to the doctrines of grace. And so they were, instead of preaching just in one church to a fixed congregation, they preached in many places and had a much broader ministry. And that laid the groundwork for the great events that are called the Second Reformation. I have number two, the Scottish Revolution. That may startle you a little bit. There is a book by a secular historian on these events, and his perspective is that what happened in Scotland in the 1630s was the first political revolution in a modern sense. And, for example, he looks upon the National Covenant that we'll talk about in a moment as the kind of manifesto of that revolutionary movement. It did end up to be an armed revolt in Scotland against the existing government, and so it can rightly be termed the Scottish Revolution. I might make a comment here. It comes up later on because during the killing times, the Covenanters also were in armed revolt against the existing government. In that sense, they were revolutionaries. And it's a difficult ethical question to think about. The British, of course, don't think very highly of the American Revolution, and they would point to Romans 13 that says, let every soul be subject to the higher powers, and say the Americans disobeyed that commandment of Scripture. England had her own revolution, though. We'll talk about the Civil War a little later here. But it's interesting to think about views of the reformers about political revolution. Martin Luther was utterly opposed to any kind of armed revolt against existing rulers. Believed that people should submit. He had a view that what happens in the civil sphere is relatively unimportant, and so you can bear with a tyrant. And probably that strong Lutheran influence in Germany lingering on had some impact in Germany's submission to Hitler's rule. They were sort of conditioned to think we must be submissive to existing governments. Luther, in his typical colorful way, said God has a lot of way to remove a tyrant. For example, he can give him kidney stones. And so we don't need to rise up in arms. Let God remove the tyrant if he wants to do that. Calvin had a different view. He said that if there is an ungodly tyrant who is ruling, it is the responsibility of the lesser magistrates who have authority to join together and to remove that wicked ruler. So a kind of a moderate view about the right of revolution. John Knox was pretty close to that, but at least in one public letter that he wrote to the common people of Scotland while he was in exile in Geneva, he said it's the responsibility of the people to see that they have a godly ruler. And so if there is an ungodly tyrant, the people have the right and the responsibility to remove that tyrant. So these are three different views. When the first Reformation happened in Scotland, and also the second Reformation, really it followed the pattern of Calvin's view, because there were those who were lesser magistrates who took the lead. A group of leaders in the Second Reformation called the Lords of the Congregation, who were the effective leaders of the movement. And what in part was behind Calvin's view is that anarchy is worse than tyranny. If you have no government at all, nobody's life is safe and things just can't operate. And we're hearing just these days that some of the bombings that have been taking place in Europe are done not by Islamic terrorists, but by anarchists who are simply trying to end all government. They somehow think that out of the chaos, something better would arise. So Calvin's idea, and he would point to examples of the people, For example, giving their allegiance to David when he became king in Israel. He would point to those biblical examples, but thought that it was very important if there's a change in government that there be order along with that and not anarchy and disorder. Well, God laid the groundwork for the revolution or the reformation that took place by granting in Scotland in the 1620s and on into the 1630s numerous revivals in which the preaching of the word had special power and effectiveness. And many people testified to being converted to Christ. Hetherington talks about this, and he's commenting on this dispersion of the godly ministers that took place because they would not follow the Articles of Perth. And here's what he says about it, and he goes on to talk about a particular revival. He says that much of the searching power of the Holy Spirit seems to have been granted to both ministers and people during a solemn fast day that was held. And many felt that in humbling themselves before God and making an earnest confession of sin, both national and individual, they obtained a spiritual strength not their own, preparing them for greater sufferings and giving earnest or down payment of final deliverance. And let any truly pious person imagine the contrast between the cold, formal, and insincere services of the prelatists, that is, those who supported the bishops and submitted to them, their cold, formal, and insincere services, and the deep, earnest, heart-wrung supplications of the Presbyterian sufferers, breathing the very essence of spiritual contrition. And he cannot fail to perceive one mighty cause of the disrespect with which the former were regarded, and the powerful hold which the latter possessed of the nation's heart. And then he goes on to describe what is called the Kirk of Shots revival, a particular instance of revival coming to a congregation. John Livingston, a man of about 27 years of age, who was at that time chaplain to the Countess of Wigton, had gone to attend the dispensation of the Lord's Supper at the Kirk of Shotts. So he was a young minister who was unable to have a regular pastorate because he wouldn't follow the Articles of Perth. He became a chaplain in a private home. And then, let me comment, he had gone to attend the dispensation of the Lord's Supper at the Kirk of Shotts. And there was a very common practice in that time. The Lord's Supper was not observed frequently, but when it was observed, people would come from all over to attend the services because there were extensive preparatory services held ahead of time. And then often on the Monday after the Lord's Supper was observed, a special Thanksgiving service. And I sometimes call these Covenanter camp meetings. That's really what they were in Scotland. People did literally camp out, and they came because of the extensive preaching that was taking place. It was time of really earnest seeking of the Lord. So this was one of those occasions. Livingston was from another place, came to be present, and he was asked to preach at the Monday service following the communion. And he agreed to do this reluctantly and with heavy misgivings of mind at the thought of his own unworthiness to address so many experienced Christians. He even endeavored to withdraw himself secretly from the multitude, but a strong, constraining impulse within his mind caused him to return and proceed with the duty to which he had been appointed, namely to preach. Towards the close of the sermon, the audience and even the preacher himself were affected with a deep, unusual awe melting their hearts and subduing their minds, stripping off prejudices, awakening the indifferent, producing conviction in the hardened, bowing down the stubborn, and imparting to many an enlightened Christian a large increase of grace and spirituality. One author who has described this says it was known, as I can speak on sure ground, that nearly 500 had at that time a discernible change wrought on them, of whom most proved lively Christians afterwards. And that's one example of many others. There was a preacher by the name of Robert Bruce that was particularly used. And there was David Dixon also, that was prominent pastor at this time. You might know he has a commentary on the Psalms that I think Banner of Truth has reprinted. So there was revival, especially in the south and the west of Scotland, in preparation for the more public and political events that took place. Well, what provoked the revolution was actions of the king. In 1636, he induced the bishops in Scotland to publish what was called a Book of Canons. When canons is used in this context, it means a book of ecclesiastical laws. And this Book of Canons forbade any criticizing of the king's supremacy in the church or the forthcoming prayer book. Now, mind you, Charles had people working on drawing up a new prayer book for the Church of Scotland, based largely upon the Book of Common Prayer in England. It had not yet been done, had not been finished, was not published. But ahead of time, the Book of Canon said, you can't criticize this book, because it would be introduced under the authority of the king. They were forbidden to criticize the episcopal form of government. And think about the background of the struggle between Presbyterians and those favoring episcopacy. The king said, there can't be any more controversy about that. You can't criticize the bishops or episcopal government. Also, the Book of Canons forbade private meetings. People could not gather together for Bible study or for prayer. And the reason for that was such meetings could not be easily controlled. Public worship could be controlled. You could have your representatives there to listen to the sermon and see what was going on. I mentioned being in Romania a number of years ago. We were in the home of a pastor who, under the communists, more than 30 times on a Monday morning was summoned down to the police station in his town to answer charges about something he had said in his sermon. So the communist secret police were there in the public worship service. We were with some people who had been arrested and sent to concentration camps. He was under that pressure. He didn't get sent to prison. But think about standing to preach, and you know that out in the congregation are not only earnest listeners, but representatives of hostile police who are taking notes carefully so that they will have grounds for accusation. And so in order to have that kind of control, Charles, through the bishops, forbade private meetings and the practice of extemporaneous prayer. This would be in public worship. you must use the prescribed written prayers and not compose your own. Well, this Book of Canons was in preparation for the publication of the 1637 Prayer Book for Scotland, drawn up largely in England and simply imposed upon the Church of Scotland. It had many elements that the Covenanters found objectionable. Instead of a communion table, they would have an altar, and what that would be, the way that would be expressed physically is that the table was removed from being in the midst of the congregation and moved to the east wall of the church. Generally speaking, churches in Europe are oriented toward the east, toward Jerusalem. You put the communion table up against the wall, and then in the Anglican worship, the prayers would be addressed to the altar with the pastor's back to the congregation. I need to tell you a story about a commemoration we had of the Westminster Assembly that was held in St. Margaret's Church in London, near right next to Westminster Abbey. And we were going to follow the order of worship in the Westminster Directory for Worship. And because I had worked on that, I was asked to preside at that worship service. And Eric Alexander, that you may know about, was going to preach. And we were waiting in a side room, and there was a member of the staff of the church with a long gown on. He was a clergyman, young guy. He said, "Now when we go in for the service, we will turn and bow to the altar, and then you will go and take your place at where the seats are," and so forth. Well, I was immediately confronted with a crisis of conscience. And you got to realize the kind of situation it was. I mean, here we're just across the street from the buildings of Parliament and Big Ben, and we're right next to Westminster Abbey. So I prayed, and I thought, and I said to him, "You'll understand if I stand respectfully but do not bow." I said, "Oh, of course." It never occurred to him there would be any kind of problem with that. Well, here's the altar in the Catholic setting. The host is there on the altar. So as an act of worship, you bow to the altar, which is the place where the sacrifice of the Mass takes place. And so the moving of the communion table to the wall of the church gives it a whole different meaning. There was, in the prescribed readings for worship, readings from the books of the Apocrypha, accepted by the Catholic Church as belonging to the canon, but not by the Protestants. There was a calendar of saints' days, the multiplication of special days that were to be observed. And the introduction of this prayer book provoked a widespread rebellion. By the way, you might be interested to know that on a way back from a trip to Europe, we met Bob Copeland in the airport in Philadelphia, and he was really excited. He'd been with the Genevans to Scotland, and in a used bookstore, he had found a nearly complete copy of the prayer book of 1637. And it's a really rare book because the events that followed meant that it was not ever used except just right at the beginning. And so there aren't many copies available. So Bob was really excited that, and he paid a big price for it, he told me, to get this prayer book of 1637. Well, when it was introduced for the first time at St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, a riot broke out. And the story is, I don't know of contemporary accounts that give her name, but the story is that a serving maid by the name of Jenny Geddes picked up her stool and threw it at the preacher who was beginning to read the liturgy from this new prayer book. And that led to a riot in the church, and the preacher had to flee. And that was the beginning of a much more widespread uprising of the people against the bishops and their policies, and behind that, what King Charles was trying to do. I hope tomorrow, if we can work out the technology to have a brief slideshow of pictures we took in Edinburgh and in Scotland. And in St. Giles Cathedral, they have a symbolic replica of Jenny Geddes' stool. It's not life size, it's bigger than that. It's for tourists who come and maybe have heard the story. But Robert Bailey, who was there that day and kept a careful journal, said there was a riot among the serving maids. So he doesn't name Jenny Geddes, but the story is accurate in that it began among the common people that were there for worship, who would not have what seemed to them to be Catholicism imposed upon them. The movement was quickly taken up by many people in Scotland, but especially the more faithful, committed Lords of Scotland, and they came to be called the Lords of the Congregation, as I mentioned earlier. Remember, said last night that the term they used for the whole Reformed Church in Scotland was the congregation. And so they recognized these political leaders who were committed to the Reformation and its principles as the Lords of the Congregation. And under their leadership, there was drawn up a covenant which came to be known as the National Covenant of 1638. If you happen to have a book like this with the title The Westminster Confession of Faith, there are many, many editions of it with lots of different bindings. This is put out most recently by the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. It has included in it the National Covenant of 1638 and later the Solemn League and Covenant, which we will talk about. Now, these folks, we've talked about the Covenanters, we've already talked about covenants. These folks were students of the Bible. They knew particularly the Old Testament. They knew that in times of Reformation and revival in Israel, when there was a return to the Lord, that it was done by way of covenant renewal. Our pastor in Grace is just going through Nehemiah, and we just had the last time the covenant, which was written by the people who had returned from captivity, and it gives the text of the covenant and the commitments they made, and then gives a list of the names of those who signed the covenant. Well, the people of Scotland regarded themselves as, in some sense, a new Israel. They thought of Scotland as a Christian nation, and so they believed that they ought to engage in covenant renewal on an occasion such as this of Reformation and revival. The covenant was made up of three parts. The first was a verbatim repetition of the first national covenant, and I gave you a sampling of that last night. And so they were regarding themselves as still bound by that earlier covenant that had been signed by King James, among others. And that was repeated. And then there was a middle section drawn up, not surprisingly, by a lawyer by the name of Archibald Johnston, who, a relative of yours, Brad?
I wish.
Same name. Later a commissioner from Scotland to the Westminster Assembly. And he became the clerk of the General Assembly that met in 1638. But he drew up a listing of all of the legislation that had been passed in the Parliament in favor of the Reformation from 1560 on. Now, much of that had been repealed by subsequent parliaments under pressure from the king, but these folks regarded that as valid and still binding legislation. So that was all listed, quite detailed and lengthy. And then a third section drawn up by Alexander Henderson that was a statement of their present commitment to the Lord and what they promised to do. And it's a fairly long document. I want to give you a little bit of a sampling of it so that you'll have a sense of what's in it. They speak about defending the true religion, and that took place at the time of the First Reformation and was expressed then in the Confession of Faith that was then written. Now, that would be the Scots Confession of 1560. They regarded that confession as embodying the true religion. A little later, they say that we promise that with our whole heart we agree and resolve all the days of our life constantly to adhere unto and to defend the aforesaid true religion, and forbearing the practice of all innovations already introduced in the matters of the worship of God. Articles of Perth would be an innovation. Prayer Book of 1637 would be an innovation. They say, we're not going to practice that. We will forbear the practice of all innovations. Or approval of the corruptions of the public government of the church. That means rule by bishops, which they regarded as a corruption of the biblical pattern. Or civil places and power of kirkmen. They have in mind there the bishops who had been given places in the government of Charles the First in Scotland and who had seats in the Parliament. And so they are opposed to rulers of the church having that kind of political power. And they commit themselves to labor by all means lawful to recover the purity and liberty of the gospel as it was established and professed before the foresaid novations. And because after due examination, we plainly perceive and undoubtedly believe that the innovations and evils contained in our complaints and protestations have no warrant of the word of God, are contrary to the aforesaid confession and to the intention and meaning of the blessed reformers of religion in this land and to the above written acts of Parliament, that is contrary to this legislation that had been passed, and do sensibly tend to the reestablishing of the popish religion and tyranny and to the subversion and ruin of the true reformed religion and of our liberties, laws, and estates. So they include in this subversion of their political or civil liberties along with the corruption of their religion. And so they're going to resist these changes, and they're going to try to maintain what was accomplished in the first Reformation. A little later, they have a statement to make about their relationship to the king. They're resisting what the king is trying to do. So listen to this. See what you make of it. We promise and swear that we shall, to the utmost of our power, with our means and lives, stand to the defense of our dread sovereign, the king's majesty, his person and authority, in the defense and preservation of the foresaid true religion, liberties, and laws of the kingdom. Now, they're resisting the king. But this is not really a hypocritical statement, because it has an important qualifier. They say, we will defend the king and his person in the defense and preservation of the foresaid true religion, liberties, and laws of the kingdom. So if the king will support the official position of the Reformation, which was made a part of the law of the land, then we will defend him. It's not stated, but it is implied. If the king continues to go against the confession of faith and what was done at the Reformation, and if he continues to subvert the liberties of the people, it's implied we will not defend him. And in fact, they did not, and before long went to war against him. So they are not revolutionary. They are not anarchists. They are calling on the king, really, to take a different direction and say, and they are saying to him, if you will do this, we will support and defend you. And then one other commitment they make that is very ironic and well-intentioned, sincere when it was made, but ironic in the light of later developments. They say that we will we commit ourselves to the defense, mutual defense and assistance, every one of us of another, in the same cause of maintaining the true religion and His Majesty's authority, with our best counsel, our body's means, and whole power, so that whatever shall be done to the least of us shall be taken as done to us all in general, and every one of us in particular. This is a mutual commitment to one another. And then, and that we shall neither directly nor indirectly suffer ourselves to be divided or without or withdrawn by whatever suggestion, allurement, or terror from this blessed and loyal conjunction. They pledge themselves not to be divided. And that was their intention. But one of the sad parts of the history through much of what followed was, in fact, the occurrence of division. And it happened very quickly. And so what had been in 1638 really a substantially united movement of the heart of the nation, later that unity disappeared. They began fighting and arguing among themselves. And so the power of the movement from that standpoint was greatly diminished. And we'll talk about that as we go along. Well, the General Assembly then... wait, yes, let me stop.
I just want to had a clarification question. The first section of the National Covenant was a restatement of what document?
That first National Covenant of 1580 or 81 that we talked about last time.
The Scots Confession?
No. This is, Brad, you asked me about Treasury of the Scottish Covenants. That was what was quoted from that. 1580 or 81, called the King's Confession or the Negative Confession, First National Covenant. So, in this volume, if you look at the National Covenant of 1638, the first section is that earlier document from 1580. There, I've seen a little bit of variation in the dates that are given, but it's from the time of King James when he was still king in Scotland. Okay? Well, the General Assembly, I didn't make it sufficiently clear because King James and then Charles so strongly favored bishops. I did mention they had restored episcopal church government in the Church of Scotland, and the bishops ruled with a vengeance. The General Assembly met only when the king permitted them to meet, and then usually with a picked membership that would be subservient to the king. So the General Assembly had not effectively met, had not freely met for a number of years. And so now, without the king's approval, the General Assembly meets. He forbade it to meet, in fact. And over against that prohibition, the General Assembly met. And they proceeded with the Reformation, the new Reformation of the Church. And let me make a comment I want to go too deeply into it. There seems to be abroad these days, I've heard it even since I came here, not from our immediate circles, a view that, rightly speaking, the civil magistrate ought to call church assemblies into being and preside over them. That's a statement that's made in the Westminster Confession. It reflects, I think, the particular situation in England at the time when the rule of the Church of England by bishops had been ended and they wanted to establish a more biblical church government, but there was no one to do it except the Parliament. And so the Parliament called the Westminster Assembly to meet to advise them about how to restructure the government of the church and other aspects of its life. And that got written into the Westminster Confession. The Church of Scotland, in approving the Westminster Confession, said about that provision, that is the civil government calling, for example, our synod to meet, that provision was all right for a church reforming, but not for a church reformed. If you hear the subtle difference. They regarded the Church of England as a church in the process of reforming. And in a kind of emergency situation, then the Parliament called together the Westminster Assembly. But for a church reformed, that is where the Reformation had been accomplished, the people in Scotland, the Covenanters in Scotland, strongly believed that the church had the freedom to meet on its own without the call of the civil magistrate. And I haven't explored deeply with people who are saying our church should not have departed from that part of the Westminster Confession, how they envision that happening. Can you think about the U.S. Congress passing a bill calling the Synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America to meet? and then appointing a czar or a committee to sit in our meetings to make sure that what we do is correct. Now, we're in quite a different situation than was true in Scotland with all people professing to be Christian, but it sends shivers up and down my spine to think about giving that power to the civil government to say when our synod would meet and to have control over the actions that are taken in the synod. And if you have occasion to read Hetherington's history of the Church of Scotland, you get a real sense of that, of how the church had to resist all through this time the insistence of the civil ruler, the king, that he would tell the church what to do. And so when I have occasion, I want to say is to folks who are talking about this sort of thing, I think it must be active on the internet, I don't know. Have you really thought about the implications of that, given our present situation? Well, the General Assembly then met. They deposed the bishops as holding an unbiblical office, and they reestablished Presbyterian church government as it had existed in 1592. That was, we talked about that last time, called the Grand Charter of Presbyterianism. Well, Charles didn't much like this, as you would expect. And he recognizes this is revolutionary action, and so he raised an army to go march north from England and put down this rebellion of his Scottish subjects. And now they didn't have airplane transports or railroads or easy ways of conveying troops, and so it took a while to raise the army. And in those days, they fought battles mainly in the summertime, not in the wintertime. So this is 1638. In the summer of 1639, Charles's army marched to north and confronted a Scottish force on the border between England and Scotland. It was skirmishing. There was not a lot of serious fighting, and it ended in a kind of standoff. And then the summer ended, and the conditions weren't favorable, so the army went back to England. And then the next summer they came again, 1640. And this time the Scots were more successful and pushed the English army back into Yorkshire. And they set kind of established positions there in a kind of standoff, but with the Scottish army actually in England. And so Charles had to yield, agree to negotiations for a peace, and those negotiations were held in London, and that was called the Treaty of London. Treaty uses a term not for the final document, but for all of the negotiations. This was quite a significant event for this reason, that the negotiators for Scotland who went to London were accompanied by chaplains, Scottish ministers, and a number of those ministers who accompanied them later were members of the Westminster Assembly. So they got acquainted on a personal level with the leaders of the Puritan movement in England, and that laid the groundwork for cooperation later on in the Westminster Assembly. And those conflicts are called the Bishops' Wars, because it had to do with the removal of the bishops from office in Scotland, and Charles was seeking to reestablish the bishops. If he had won the war, there would have been Episcopal government again in Scotland. Let me stop with that, but give you an opportunity for questions before we break.
Was it you said just a second ago about them, about laying the groundwork for them cooperating with the Puritan leaders?
Yes.
how that happened, you said?
There were Scottish ministers who accompanied the political negotiators as chaplains. And so the negotiations took considerable time in London, and during that time, they would be invited to preach in the pulpits of the Puritans and had other interaction with them, and so got acquainted. Alexander Henderson, for example, that was the really the leader of the Scottish delegation to the Westminster Assembly, was one of those chaplains. Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's take a break. I've mentioned already the instance of the Articles of Perth, which were an ungodly action on the part of the king and of the subservient General Assembly, which passed them. But that evil used by God for good, think of Joseph and his brothers, you meant it for evil, their wicked selling him into slavery. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And that happens over and over again in this history. And so here is the king's effort to suppress the new reformation of the church in Scotland by military means, in which he is defeated. But he was not only defeated, and therefore the establishment of Presbyterianism remained in Scotland, but those events led to something of much more extensive significance, and that is the calling of the Westminster Assembly. So I'm going to talk about that next. And here's how it's connected. It takes money to fight wars. You have to buy munitions, you have to have rations for the troops, you have to have equipment. And Charles I had endeavored since early in his reign to rule England without a parliament. He really believed in absolute monarchy and that the king ought to be the one who makes the laws and who levies the taxes and who controls everything without having to deal with a troublesome parliament that would get in the way of what he wants to do. So for 11 years, he ruled without parliament. He raised money by things like tariffs and selling monopolies to his friends in certain realms of economic activity. And so he managed, Parliament had the legal and traditional right to raise taxes. The members of Parliament came from the counties throughout England. They were the ones who were in position to enforce the collection of taxes, and so only Parliament could levy taxes. But Charles's treasury was exhausted by the expense of the two bishops' wars, and so, contrary to what he wanted to do, he had to call Parliament into session and to ask them to levy a special tax to replenish the coffers of the government. In the meantime, Parliament, the English Parliament, especially the House of Commons, had come to be dominated by Puritans. And I need to take a bit of a detour and to describe that for a moment. It's another instance of God overruling evil for good. Queen Elizabeth was probably not herself a particularly religious person, but she thought that it was for the good of the kingdom that there be a strong, unified Church of England. And so she had the Church of England be Protestant. She got that legislation through Parliament. She was named the head of the Church of England, but there was a party a group of people within the Church of England, ministers in particular, who wanted to go further with the reformation of the Church of England. In God's providence, if you think back about the history we talked about last night, many of them had been the exiles who went to Europe during the reign of Bloody Mary, and there were influenced by Calvin and others, and came back wanting to see the Church of England reformed along those lines, the same kind of reform that John Knox had advocated in Scotland. And those folks, those so-called Marian exiles, were the seedbed from which the Puritan movement grew in England. During the reign of Elizabeth, they took the route of trying to get legislation in Parliament to have a Presbyterian church government in England rather than Episcopal, to have the worship less ceremonial and more biblical after the model of Geneva. But Elizabeth suppressed those efforts and drove the Puritans into a kind of underground existence. They were not severely persecuted, but they were not allowed to operate openly. And so, like the folks removed from pastorates in Scotland over the Articles of Perth, these people continued to function in private houses. They spread their doctrines by way of the printing press. There's a quite exciting story about a secret underground printing press that was carried from place to place to escape the authorities, putting out Puritan literature. And they got opportunities to preach, sometimes in the afternoons in parish churches, not in official worship services, but in what were called lectureships, and especially they had places where they could preach in institutions of learning, particularly the law schools of London. So what do lawyers do? Many of them grow up and become members of Parliament. And in God's providence, it came to be that in the 1640s, the leaders of the House of Commons were earnest Puritans, including the Speaker of the House of Parliament, John Pym. So here's a long, slow, faithful effort to spread the truth of the Scripture, to inculcate it in institutions of learning in this case, and the fruit of that was a Parliament at the heart of power in England, led by those who were committed to the gospel and to the ideals of the Puritans. So what happens when King Charles calls Parliament into session? He says, I need to have a tax. Here's the legislation. They said, we will consider your legislation if you will grant us the following reforms in the Church of England. And so they had a long list, both of grievances and of what they wanted to see happen in the further reformation of the Church of England. In the first meeting of the Parliament, they had a stalemate. They met, I think, for 3 weeks. And in history, that meeting of Parliament is called the Short Parliament. Met for 3 weeks. And Charles struggled along for another time, trying to get by without the tax, and he found he couldn't manage it, so reluctantly he called Parliament into session again, and that time the session was called the Long Parliament, because it met from 1641, until after the execution of Charles in 1647 or 48. So it outlasted Charles. And again, with this Puritan leadership, the Parliament, especially the House of Commons, took steps immediately to get the King's support for further reformation of the Church of England. Charles resisted that. He decided that the leaders of the House of Commons were plotting against him. He charged them with treason. He actually sent an armed troop to the House of Commons to arrest the five leading members of the House of Commons. The Parliament got word that this was going to happen, and so they raised what amounted to the National Guard in the city of London, again sympathetic to the Puritans because of the preaching and the teaching that had taken place. And so they stymied Charles's effort to arrest the leaders of the House of Commons. Charles had to flee from the city of London, which was hostile to him, raised his army, and prepared for war. And this was the beginning of the great English Civil War, which was between the Parliament, especially the House of Commons, and the King and his supporters. The war officially began the next year, in the summer 1642, and went on for a number of years, all during the time when the Westminster Assembly was meeting. And I'm bringing in now in this course on RP history the Westminster Assembly because it's been a very important factor in the life and belief of our church through its documents. And you may have the question, we're talking about an assembly that met in England. How did it happen that it had such an impact in Scotland? So that's why I'm seeking to describe it here. From 1641 on, in the Parliament, there were many calls for an assembly of ministers who would give direction to this further reformation of the Church of England, but they were always stymied by the King, who would not sign a bill calling such an assembly. You can well understand why he would refuse to do that. But after civil war breaks out, the Parliament decides to go ahead on their own and call an assembly. And then, as now, laws that were in were debated in the Parliament and passed were called bills. This time they passed not a bill but an ordinance. It's the first time in which there was a legal enactment from Parliament given that name, an ordinance of Parliament calling into being the Westminster Assembly. And that assembly began meeting in the summer of 1643 with the assignment from the government to advise the Parliament in the further reformation of the Church of England in doctrine, government, catechizing, and worship. And if you know the work of the Westminster Assembly, the documents that they produced after a number of years of work covered those areas. Also, that summer of 1643, things were not going well for the parliamentary side in the Civil War. Charles had better trained troops, especially better leadership, and the parliamentary army lost a number of significant battles and were in danger of losing the war. And so they decided to ask Scotland for help. Now think about already the relationship established in the Treaty of London that had been held not long before this. Scotland had successfully resisted Charles militarily and had forced him to back down. Scotland was a poor country, and many of their young men went to fight as mercenaries in the wars that were going on almost continually in Europe, so they had experienced soldiers and generals, and so they would be a valuable ally for the Parliament in fighting against the king. So they sent a delegation to Scotland, a commission they were called, to ask for Scotland's help. And those commissioners worked out a document, an agreement, on the basis of which Scotland would come into the war on the parliamentary side. And that document was called the Solemn League and Covenant. There's a lot of debate about even the title of that. Robert Bailey said, talking about those negotiations, the English were for a civil league, but we were for a religious covenant. Now, I'm not sure what all Bailey meant by that, but he didn't mean what later people have taken that to mean. That is, that this was simply a political treaty, but the Scots wanted to make something religious out of it. The Puritans in England, just at this time, had drawn up and sworn two covenants on their own that were very similar to the Scottish National Covenant. And as I said earlier, this practice of covenanting was not limited to the Scots. Huguenots did it, the Waldensians did it, the Puritans did it. And so they didn't have the kind of sharp distinction in their minds between civil and religious that we have in our own times. The answer to the question, was it a civil league or a religious covenant, is yes. It was both a civil league and a religious covenant. And in those times, people did not make a sharp wall of separation between those two spheres. So thus we have the document called the Solemn League and Covenant. It's found here. It's much briefer than the National Covenant. And so I just give you a summary. It named as parties to the covenant the nations of England, Scotland, and Ireland. And it's worthwhile making a comment about Ireland here, because there were no Irish representatives in Scotland when the covenant was being drafted. Ireland was not consulted. But the king had the title to the throne over Ireland as well as Scotland and England, and so they included Ireland. Now, that's significant because that tends to be typical of the way in which Ireland has been treated by England all along. And it continues down to the present day with the troubles in Ireland between the Catholic Irish and the Protestant Irish who are in the north. And we'll talk about why there came to be a large number of Protestant Irish in the northern counties a little later on. But so I just mentioned incidentally, without consulting Ireland, Ireland was included in the covenant. The covenant pledged the nations to preservation of the Reformed religion in Scotland and the reformation of religion in England, and I hope, and in Ireland. I hope now that you will understand what that means. There had been the successful revolt against the king in Scotland, the establishment, as they believed, of a truly reformed church with a Presbyterian government. They committed themselves to the preservation of that, the maintenance of the state of affairs in Scotland. But there was an Archbishop of Ireland, there was Archbishop of Canterbury and the whole Episcopal structure in England. And so it was their conviction that there was a need for further reformation in England and in Ireland, as they said, according to the word of God and the example of the best reformed churches. And the Solemn League and Covenant committed the three nations, and this is the language of the covenant, to uniformity in religion, that is, in confession of faith, the form of church government, directory for worship, and catechizing. And again, those are the things that were dealt with by the Westminster Assembly. Now, we used to have a student who came from Church of England. Oh, this comes right home to you folks. Who came from Church of England congregation in South Africa. And the lady who was here on the Lord's Day knew this student, Lee De Hoff, who came and studied in our seminary. But he was from an Anglican church, so some of our less reverent students ought to give him grief. They used to give him grief by saying our covenant calls for the extirpation of prelacy. Extirpation meaning the elimination of, the removal of prelacy. Well, here again, they are aiming for one national church, not a multiplicity of denominations, one national church which will be truly biblical and reformed, and therefore will have Presbyterian church government, not Episcopal. They also mentioned, I didn't put it in the notes, independency. They don't aim to allow for there to be congregational churches. There will be one national church in each of the three nations with uniformity among the nations. So it will have similar doctrine and worship and government in all three of the nations. The ideas of freedom of religion in our modern sense were not embraced in that period of history. Then the covenant also calls for the preservation of the rights of Parliament and of the King's authority. And here again, the commitment to preserving the King's authority has the important qualifier, so long as the King will defend the true reformed religion and the rights of the nations and the rights of the people. We will support, they were engaged in war, civil war against him. But they're saying if he will change his position and his action and his behavior, then we are quite ready to support his legitimate authority. And they express the hope in the Solemn League and Covenant that other nations will come to join in this covenant. And I put in brackets their millennial views. The modern terms of premillennialism and amillennialism and postmillennialism were not used in that time in the 17th century. But there was a very strong post-millennial perspective that was embraced by many of the Puritans. If you read carefully, I think it is embodied in the Westminster Confession and the Catechisms. George Gillespie preached before Parliament at the beginning of 1643, or in the fall of 1643, on the Book of Revelation, and he made a calculation there from the numbers of years that are given in the Book of Revelation, and said, this brings us up to this very year, 1643, in which the millennium is going to begin. Antichrist, the papacy, will be overthrown, and Christ will fully reign over the nations of the world. They expected that to happen soon in their lifetime. They thought they were a part of that kind of a movement. And not because they would bring it about, but they thought that's what prophecy foretold. Ian Murray has written a book called The Puritan Hope, in which he gives evidence of this kind of perspective that prevailed among the Puritans. And Murray argues it was this perspective that was the impetus for the development of the modern missionary movement, people like William Carey and others. I've seen it in David Livingston. Now, I'm talking here historically. I'm not here trying to make a case for postmillennialism. I'm either a postmillennialist or an optimistic amillennialist, depending on the definition of the terms. So I don't share the method of interpreting the book of Revelation that Gillespie used. By the way, I've recently discovered it in Jonathan Edwards in his History of the Work of Redemption. He was also a postmillennialist who actually finds in the book of Revelation prophecy, and Edwards does, not only of the downfall of the papacy, but of Islam. Finds that prophesied in the book of Revelation. Well, book of Revelation is a tough book, so. But there was this kind of optimism, and not only that God in the long run would bring about the triumph of the kingdom, but they expected to see it in their day. And when we're thinking about the history of the Reformed Presbyterian Church, that kind of perspective was dominant in the church up until the middle of the 20th century. For example, Alexander MacLeod, who was the leading scholar and preacher of the church in the early part of the 19th century, wrote a book on Revelation, in which he found the date for the millennium to begin was 1866. Well, I've often said, if this is the millennium, I'm greatly disappointed. But it was this method of calculating the numbers in Revelation and finding a starting point of the papacy and then calculating forward 1,262 years, and then you come to the time of the downfall of the Pope and of the beginning of the millennium. Now, I'm being descriptive. I'm saying that's been a perspective that has been characteristic of our church, and it was with considerable angst that the church moved from being predominantly postmillennial to being predominantly, at least in its ministers, amillennial. Some revival recently, however, of postmillennialism. Well, that's a Solemn League and Covenant. Do you have questions or comments that you'd like to ask about? Well, that's the basic amillennial position.
Isn't that also postmillennial belief?
It depends. The recent revival of postmillennialism uses a method of interpreting Revelation that's called preterist or partial preterist. The older form of postmillennialism was used a historicist way of interpretation. So it's a different way of looking at it. And that's why the matter of definition becomes tricky. But the classical, the older postmillennialists thought that there was a definite point in history in the future from their standpoint when the kingdom of Christ would really be established. They wouldn't deny that he has been reigning since his resurrection, but that there would be the inauguration of a time of widespread acceptance of the gospel and temporal prosperity and social righteousness that would follow from that, but at such a definite time that you could pinpoint its beginning. And some of those classical postmillennialists thought that the 1,000 years was literal, that it would be for an exact period of 1,000 years. The more recent postmillennialism, I've heard one adherent here and say, millennium may be 30,000 years of peace and righteousness, you know. I would be happy if that turns out to be right. Don't know. So, any other questions or comments? Yes.
What about
That's a good out. Yeah.
It's not good interpretation.
It's also biblical. It's also biblical. He will reign until all enemies will be put under his feet. Let me tell you how this came to expression in practical devotion. My father died when I was quite young. He was very faithful in leading us in family worship, but as I look back on it, and I wasn't old enough to talk to him about it, and don't know, he fell into a pattern of very kind of stereotyped prayers in family worship. We all are inclined to do that in one way or another. But I don't think that was a good thing in itself, but it did impress upon my mind as a 10-year-old or earlier this verse in Scripture. Almost every night my father would pray, "Lord, hasten the day when the knowledge of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea, and no one will say to his neighbor, 'Know the Lord,' for all will know me from the least until the greatest." And in a devotional way, that's the expression of this hope. Now, the difference of opinion is to when that will be fully accomplished. You don't need to be a postmillennialist to claim that promise and to pray it. But the Lord knows when it will be fulfilled. Okay. Scottish participation in the Westminster Assembly, page 5. In implementing the Solemn League and Covenant, it was agreed that there would be representatives from Scotland who would go to London to participate in the deliberations of the Westminster Assembly. They went as what we would call today consultative members. That is to say, they did not have voting privileges, but they were allowed to participate in the deliberations and in the meetings of the committees. And in fact, they did a lot of drafting for the documents of the Westminster Assembly. So they had a very great influence in the work of the Assembly, even though they didn't have a vote when it came to the making of decisions. There were 6 of them. I give them their names here. Alexander Henderson. He had been the moderator of the General Assembly in 1638. He was probably the leader of the Church of Scotland at this period of time, highly respected by others. Samuel Rutherford. You would know that name. He's known very widely in Christian and evangelical circles because of the repeated publication of his devotional letters, the letters of Samuel Rutherford. But he also wrote more serious theological works, especially a work called Lex Rex, which had to do with nature of the king in relationship to law. A kind of political philosophy, if you will. There's a conservative Christian think tank called the Rutherford Institute that looks back to Samuel Rutherford. George Gillespie was a young man in his 20s, about 26, and a very powerful debater in the Westminster Assembly. Robert Bailey, it's not recorded that he ever spoke in the Westminster Assembly, but he was an inveterate journalist. That is, he kept a journal, and he wrote letters all over to people from the Westminster Assembly. So the letters and journals of Robert Bailey are one of the most valuable historical sources for the Assembly and for the events of this time. And then there were two laymen, Archibald Johnston. They were elders, ruling elders in the Church of Scotland. Archibald Johnston was the lawyer that had compiled the middle part of the National Covenant, the clerk of the General Assembly in 1638. And then there was, we'll talk, Lord willing, tomorrow night about the Restoration when Charles II came to the throne. Archibald Johnston paid with his life for his participation in the Second Reformation and the Westminster Assembly. He was executed for his involvement. In our synod, we have a practice that's written down in the rules for synod that if you disagree with a decision of synod, you can have your dissent recorded. People do that as a matter of conscience from time to time on important issues. That was also a part of the rules of the Westminster Assembly, but it had a more serious purpose there. They were in a civil war. They knew if they lost the civil war, they were going to be in trouble. And so if they did not agree with something that the Westminster Assembly decided, they wanted to have it in writing so that they could use it in their defense when they came to trial later on. Well, despite what defense he may have made, Archibald Johnston was in fact executed soon after 1660. And then there was a man from the nobility, Lord Maitland, also quite a young man. The other commissioners very highly impressed with him. And he had a natural rapport with the leaders of Parliament and especially members of the House of Lords because he was from the nobility. But there's a great tragedy greater than that of Archibald Johnston connected with him, because after the Restoration, when Charles II came to the throne, Lord Maitland turned his back on the Covenanters and became the Lord High Commissioner for Scotland under Charles II and the leader of the fierce persecution of the Covenanters. And so he was a Judas who betrayed the cause to which he had earlier on professed adherence. And then the outcome of the Westminster Assembly, I skipped over one line or two. Decisions of the Assembly had to be ratified by the Scottish Church and Parliament, as well as by the English Parliament. So, again, you have a union of church and state. The decisions of the Westminster Assembly only become effective if they are ratified by the government. That was true both in England and Scotland. And the result of that is that there was one very important document of the Westminster Assembly called the Directory for Government, which has simply fallen out of people's knowledge because it was not ratified either by the English Parliament or by the Scottish Church or Parliament. But I'll talk in the outcome about how that ratification took place in Scotland. Well, in England, Oliver Cromwell was a cavalry commander who began to win many battles on the side of the Parliament against the king, and thus came to have great political power, and eventually ended up leading in the condemnation of Charles the First for treason and of his beheading in the city of London. I don't know if any of you have ever had a tourist tour of London. It's really quite discouraging because they'll take you to the Tower of London and they say, this is the block where Anne Boleyn was beheaded. And this is the stairway where the children of Richard the Lionhearted were imprisoned and maybe starved to death. And then you go past the building and they show you a second story window and they say this is the window through which Charles I was led out onto a platform to be beheaded. And these were barbarous times. And public executions, and after the executions, we'll see this in the Killing Times, the head and the hands of the people who had been executed put on spikes on castle walls as a warning to everybody else going by. So barbarous times. But in any case, and also a further comment I would make, in those days, if you lost an important political battle, you didn't retire to Crawford, Texas, or some other nice place like that. You were executed for treason. And it happened over and over again, and it happened to Charles I. Well, Cromwell led in that, and then set himself up as a military dictator in England, in what is called the interregnum. But Cromwell was a Congregationalist. He didn't believe in a national church. He didn't believe in episcopacy. He didn't believe in Presbyterianism. And so when he came to power, he put a stop to the implementation of the decisions of the Westminster Assembly, even those that had been approved by the Parliament. There had been a presbytery set up in London, another one in another part of England briefly, but Cromwell put a stop to that and ended really the Presbyterian movement in England. And so this is another example of good out of evil. And to say it starkly, the Westminster Assembly failed in its stated purpose. It was a failure in terms of its stated purpose because it aimed at the reformation of the Church of England and the Church of Ireland, and that didn't come about. But it was approved in Scotland and had a great impact there. And then wherever Scottish immigrants went and wherever Scottish missionaries went, the Westminster documents were carried and helped to shape the church really all over the world. So you can go to Japan and get the Westminster Confession in Japanese. And that's true in a number of other languages as well. After Charles came to the throne, all the Westminster documents were condemned, burned by the publicly by the public hangman, and those who adhered to them were fiercely persecuted.
The Restoration, that's Charles?
That's Charles II, 1660, and that we come to that, I think, before we end tonight. We'll just touch on it briefly. 1660. In Scotland, the General Assembly of the Church and then the Parliament, called the Estates, had approved the document called the Form of Presbyterial Church Government, the Directory for Worship, the Confession of Faith, and the larger and shorter catechisms. However, Cromwell invaded Scotland and he hampered the implementation even there of these documents. They were outlawed during the rule of Charles II and James II. And then after the revolution of 1688, the Confession of Faith became the official creed in the Church of Scotland. The other documents were not reinstated. But as I say in the notes, they continued to have a great influence in Scotland, especially in the instruction of the youth. That would be true of the catechisms, especially the shorter catechism. John Murray at Westminster, who was a Scotsman, said, "The Scots are strong because of oatmeal and the shorter catechism." So it's really did shape the theology and the life of the nation, even though it was not officially adopted by the Church of Scotland after 1688. But the other documents, not least because they've been printed in this collection, have continued to exert a considerable influence in Scotland and in other places. This is a kind of curiosity to me. It has quite a number of different documents. They're not all Westminster documents. Some of them come from the Church of Scotland directly. For example, the Directory for Family Worship. When we had the commemoration of the Assembly in 1993, the organizers proposed that we have a lecture given on the Directory for Family Worship, assuming that it was a Westminster document. And I'd been asked to be a historical consultant for that commemoration, and I wrote to the committee and said, it's in this collection of documents, but it's not from Westminster, it's from the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. But this same collection, including all the typographical errors, has been faithfully reproduced ever since the 17th century, published over and over again by all kinds of different publishers. So if a document is in this book, it's probably has had significant influence in churches that follow the Westminster documents. And, for example, has the Sum of Saving Knowledge and the Sum of Practical Knowledge and other documents like that. Well, this is appropriate place to take a break. And we'll not go for the full third hour, but I want to make a little bit of progress beyond where we are now. So let's take a break. I will just plan to cover Roman numeral 1 and 2 before we end tonight. So let's talk first of all about the monarchy. And in each section, I try to give you this kind of scorecard. Charles I was the son, as you remember, of James, who is James VI in Scotland and James I in England. I have to tell you something I forgot earlier about James I. When he was traveling south to England to take up the throne there, he was met at Hampton Court by a delegation of Puritan ministers who had a number of requests to make of him. He thought that, they thought that he would, since he'd been raised in Presbyterian Scotland, that he would be favorable to their cause. They were sadly disappointed, but they appealed to him to support the effort to have a Presbyterian government in the Church of England. And he is reported to have given two answers, a short and a long. The short answer was, no bishop, no king. No bishop, no king. And I'm talking about a chessboard. But what was true through all of this time was that the bishops were the strongest supporters of the king, and indeed of his policy of absolute authority as the monarch, the divine right of kings. The bishops supported that. Not surprisingly, in turn, King James and then his son King Charles strongly supported the bishops and supported Episcopal government. So his idea is, if you Puritans succeeded and got rid of bishops, I wouldn't be the king any longer. No bishop, no king. The longer answer is a little more colorful. He said, if you aim at a presbytery, meaning presbyterial church government, if you aim at presbytery, it agreeth as well with monarchy as God and the devil. So he regarded Presbyterianism as incompatible with a monarchical form of government. And so he reinstated the bishops in Scotland, kept bishops in England, and they were his strong allies. Charles I, about 1640 or 41, induced the meeting of bishops of the Church of England to pass a rule that said that four times a year in every parish church in England, that would be 10,000 churches, four times a year the pastor must read a proclamation that said, anyone who resists the authority of the king will eternally perish. So, threatening damnation to anyone who resisted the authority of the king. So this is the mutual support of king and bishop. Well, Charles I was condemned for treason and executed in London. It's kind of a historical curiosity, but if you have dates in British history that have, like here, 1648/49, the reason for that is that the calendar was changed in Europe from Gregorian to Julian. And it happens that it was changed sooner in Scotland than it was in England. So in the old calendar, the new year began on March 25th. And so in the old calendar, it's the previous year, in this case 1648 until March, and then 1649 begins in just the last few days of March. In Scotland, in January, it's already the next year. So that's what the slash means. It's 1648 in England in January, which is when Charles was executed. The calendar was already changed in Scotland, and it was 1649 there. Charles I, just in the closing days of the Civil War, when it's obvious that his side was losing, fled to the Isle of Wight, which is a small island just off the south coast of England. And there he was kind of the guest of a wealthy man there. And some nobles came from Scotland who were in favor of the Stuart kings, who were royalists, and they promised Charles that they would raise an army of loyalists in Scotland in support of Charles, not like the Scottish army that was fighting in favor of the Parliament. This would be a different army. They would raise an army to restore Charles to the throne. And in exchange for that, Charles promised to allow the Solemn League and Covenant, and not to outlaw it, but to allow it, and then to support Presbyterianism in Scotland for 3 years. This is not a long commitment, but for the time being, he's willing to support Presbyterianism in Scotland. And the people, this was called a secret engagement, and the people who were favorable to it and adhered to it came to be called the engagers. We get some kind of unfamiliar terms now. The engagers, because they supported this engagement, this agreement that they would fight to restore Charles to the throne, and they did raise an army and marched southward England and was soundly defeated by Cromwell and his forces. Subsequently, as they reflected on that, the Scottish Parliament, which is strongly reformed and Presbyterian at this point, passed an act which excluded people who had supported the engagement, the engagers, excluded them from service in the government and in the army. And it was called the Act of Classes because there were different levels of culpability for involvement in the engagement. Well, in the next year, 1650, the commission of the General Assembly, that would be like an ad interim commission of our presbyteries, the commission of the General Assembly passed resolutions which called for the repeal of the Act of Classes. In other words, the people who were in favor of these resolutions were inclined to be favorable to the engagement. At least they didn't want the engagers excluded from public life. And those who were a part of this movement were called the resolutioners. So, and later then, there was a reaction to that, a protest against that, and those who adhered to that were called protesters. And this led then to a very serious division among the Covenanters that really impacted the church and that continued on after this time. I mentioned in the National Covenant there was a commitment not to allow themselves to be divided. That was their commitment. That's what they intended. Now comes a really serious division in the church and in the nation between the resolutioners and the protesters. And this continued on into the time of persecution so that the people who are our ecclesiastical ancestors, the strict covenanters, they're sometimes called, or the Cameronians, they were almost entirely from the protester side, the stricter side. They said these compromisers who have been willing to bring back the king on this shaky ground of maintaining Presbyterianism for only 3 years, they're compromisers. They should be excluded from public life. They were the stricter party. And later on, the strict covenanters were taken from among those ranks. And the division was very severe among godly people. And I mention here Dixon and Rutherford. They were co-pastors of a congregation. And I'm not remembering now in which of the cities it was. It probably either Edinburgh or Glasgow, but a very a prominent church. They were co-pastors. Dixon was a resolutioner, a very godly man. I mentioned him in connection with the revivals early on and his wonderful commentary on the Book of Psalms, but he was a resolutioner. And Rutherford was a protester, and they were co-pastors. It comes time for communion, what are they going to do? They could not agree about who would be admitted to the Lord's table because of this split. And so for 4 years, that congregation went without the Lord's Supper because the division was so sharp. And that's just an anecdote about how this impacted the church. And Satan's device is to divide his people. When you think about these controversies, it's always kind of an existential thing for me. Which side would I have been on? And we tend to have different temperaments. Some said, well, if we have the freedom to preach the gospel, we can yield on some of these points. Hetherington said the protesters were probably over rigid in their views, but that was the division. And if someone were to say, well, in the National Covenant, you promised to avoid division, what would they say? Well, we didn't cause the division. If you would agree with us, then we wouldn't have division. And both sides would say that kind of thing. And so the history becomes a history of ongoing and multiplied divisions among people who in the height of the Second Reformation had been well united in what they were committed to. It's a warning to us, I think. And we're in a new congregation. We pray all the time. And we've gone through a building program. You know what that can do. We pray all the time, Lord, protect us from division. Keep us united. And he's been doing that. But we need to pray that for the church all the time. Pray that for our congregations and for the church more broadly. We used to have in the seminary library an elaborate chart in a nice frame with a kind of Gothic matting around it, a chart of the divisions and the reunions of the Church of Scotland. I think we've now put it away. But the way in which it was portrayed was as though this were the glory of the Church of Scotland. You know, they say you find one Scotsman, you find a church. You find two Scotsmen, you find two churches. And sadly, that's been the history. The other side of that is that some of the unions that have taken place have not worked out very well. So it's not all one-sided. But anyway, that will be an ongoing part of the story that we'll be talking about. And one of the things that really is amazing to me and a reason for great gratitude will be seeing that in the last 40 years, the RP Church in this country has gone through enormous changes. But we've gone through those changes without being divided. Doesn't mean we all agree, but we have not had a division. And I pray that that will continue. So we'll stop with that tonight.